You're listening to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. I'm your host, HI Assistant Director Amy Meppam. Samuel F.B. Morse is perhaps best known for his invention of the single-wire telegraph system and the co-inventor of Morse code. However, he was also an artist, and his work, The Gallery of the Louvre, is the subject of today's episode, a conversation with Morna O'Neill, Associate Professor of Art History at Wake Forest University. Professor O'Neill discusses Morse's identity as an artist, his intentions in creating the Gallery of the Louvre, his relationship to technology, and the questions this particular painting raises for contemporary audiences. Professor O'Neill will also moderate the special event for Wake Forest faculty, Decoding Morse, Cross-Disciplinary Conversation and a Viewing of Samuel F.B. Morse's Gallery of the Louvre at 3 p.m. on Friday, February 24th. You can find more information about this event at humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/decodingmorse. Morse's painting is on display during the exhibition Samuel F.B. Morse's Gallery of the Louvre and the Art of Invention at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art, which opens Friday, February 17th, and runs through June 4th, 2017. Visit rinaldahouse.org for more information. Samuel F.B. Morse's Gallery of the Louvre and the Art of Invention was organized by and with support from the Terra Foundation for American Art. Rinalda House is grateful for the generous sponsorship of this exhibition from major co-sponsor Wake Forest Innovation Quarter and Wake Forest University Baptist Medical Center, contributing sponsors the Terra Foundation for American Art, and an anonymous donor, and exhibition partners Joya Johnson and Jeff and Sissy Whittington. Morna O'Neill is Associate Professor of Art History in the Department of Art at Wake Forest University, where she teaches courses in 18th and 19th century European art and the history of photography. Prior to her arrival at Wake Forest, she taught in the History of Art Department at Vanderbilt University and served as a postdoctoral research associate in the Department of Research at the Yale Center for British Art. Her scholarship addresses the conjunction of art, design, and politics at the end of the 19th century. She is the author of Walter Crane, The Arts and Crafts, Painting and Politics, Yale University Press, 2011. She also curated the exhibition Art and Labor's Cause is One, Walter Crane in Manchester, 1880-1915, Whitworth Art Gallery, University of Manchester, August 2008 to June 2009. She is currently preparing a book manuscript on the art dealer Hugh Lane and the rise of the global art market. She is the co-editor with Michael Hatt of The Edwardian Sense, Art, Design, and Performance in Britain, 1901-1910, Yale University Press, 2010. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thanks for being here today to talk about Samuel Morse. Many people, if they know Samuel Morse, know him as the creator of Morse code. However, he was a successful painter first, as well as an inventor. What can you tell the listeners about who Samuel Morse was, particularly his identity as an artist?
Yes, well, Morse was born in 1791, and he came from a pretty strict Protestant background, actually Calvinist. Mm-hmm. And there was this sense, I think, that the United States had sort of, the creation of the United States had initiated a kind of divinely predestined period of peace, so that the United States was going to be a leader in the world. His father was a geographer, and so Morse grew up with an interest in travel. And that really, I think, went hand in hand with his interest in art. He studied at Yale, and he actually kind of funded his social life at Yale by painting portraits. So you could buy a lot of snuff, I guess, with a few portraits under your belt. And he trained with a very well-established American painter named Washington Allston. In 1811, he took a really important step artistically, and that's when he sailed to London to join a circle of American artists who were already students there. Many of them were students at the prestigious Royal Academy in London. And it's important to note that at this time, two of the leading artists in London were actually born in the U.S., mm-hmm. were colonial. John Singleton Copley was from Boston and Benjamin West from Philadelphia. Mm-hmm. So in a way, Morse was joining a very kind of illustrious lineage as part of this artistic training. And at the Royal Academy, he would have learned things like how to create pictorial perspective, mm-hmm. proper anatomical drawing from usually the nude, the study of ancient Greek sculpture, mm-hmm. as well as an admiration for Italian Renaissance painting, which is something that you can very much see on display in the Gallery of the Louvre. Mm-hmm. It's also fascinating to think about Morse as an art student in London in 1812, because, of course, this is when the right. mm-hmm. young United States was at war right. with Great Britain. Mm-hmm. And so against that kind of backdrop, Morse also learned a really hard truth about being a professional artist in this period. The Royal Academy taught painters that the most important subjects for art were what were called history paintings. History, religion, mythology, legend. Because it was thought these would elevate the mind of the viewer, and they would also demonstrate the intellect of the artist. But, as he knew from being a student at Yale, what actually made money was portraiture, mm-hmm. especially in the period before the invention of photography, when the main mode of depicting a loved one would have been to pay right. to have them painted. Mm-hmm. So we have to imagine that Morse is kind of learning this and sort of coming into his sense of being an American abroad when he returns to the United States in 1815. And at that point, he really embarks on a successful career as a portrait painter, but also works to create institutions that help emulate the Royal Academy model of training. Mm-hmm. And the most famous one we could say he's involved in is called the National Academy of Design. It's set up in New York, and it actually still is going today. So Morse, back in the United States in the 1820s, he's maturing as an artist in a time of territorial expansion, American population growing through immigration, also new developments in technology, and as I said, the establishment of art organizations. So we can think of him as playing a vital role mm-hmm. in sort of creating this new culture, and of course thinking about culture, technology, and commerce coming together in his career. It's in 1829 that he returns to Europe, and in that period embarks on the painting that would become the Gallery of the Louvre. There he falls in with a group of expatriate American artists, the landscape painter Thomas Cole, one of whose works is also on display at Rinalda House, and the novelist James Fenimore Cooper. And we can think about Morse in Paris at this moment in one way, thinking about the democratic access to culture. So many Americans, most Americans, are not going to be able to travel to see the Louvre. So how is his painting going to bring back that culture and sort of allow them access to them? It should be acknowledged that this painting was a pretty big failure. And that when he brought it back to the States and put it on display, the idea was that members of the public could pay 25 cents to see it. I think in one day he earned $3. So not fabulous. And, you know, this was a popular thing for artists to do. Actually, it was a strategy that was pioneered by John Singleton Copley in London. You'd hire out a hall or erect a tent, and you'd charge money, and you would show off some fantastic new work that you had created. But most of the time it was battle painting or a topical event. Morse had tried this earlier in his career with a scene of the House of Representatives. So something sort of newsworthy in this moment before internet, television, movies, radio, before even the telegraph. And, you know, I think that this painting, it rewards close looking and study, and it's smaller than visitors might have expected. So it wasn't quite the splash that he was hoping for. And it was actually the failure of this exhibit that led Morse to move away from art. And it was on his way home from Paris that he had the idea to take the sort of semaphore telegraph system and allied it to electromagnetic technology to create the telegraph. So discouraged by the flop, he then turned to a life of an inventor, which is how we perhaps know him more so today.
Yeah, so you've mentioned the Gallery of the Louvre, which is on exhibit at Rinalda House Museum of American Art. You've given us a little bit of the history of that painting. Could you talk maybe a little bit more specifically about it and incorporate what Morse was attempting to communicate through this particular piece?
Absolutely. Well, there are a couple of things to think about, sort of famous last words, because I'll probably mention six or seven. But the first is that, okay, so what is Morse doing in Paris? So he's been to London and he's had the training, but I think probably up until the 1960s, and maybe even some people still today think if you really want to be an artist, you need to have this period of study in Paris. So he returns to Europe in 1829, and he's spending about almost 2 years in Paris from sort of 1831 onward. This is a pretty interesting time to be in Paris because he arrives in September of 1831, and there had actually been a revolution in, in late July, which forced the abdication of the king, who was replaced by another king. So it's a time of political turmoil for the French. And in some ways, that political turmoil is also related to artistic turmoil. Mm-hmm. Maybe the most famous painting of the revolution that just happened in 1831 is by Eugène Delacroix. It's called Liberty Leading the People. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And that painting was on display in the Louvre mm-hmm. when Morse would have been working there. So one of the interesting decisions that he makes is that he's not interested in contemporary or even recent French art. Instead, he's going to the Louvre, I think in the way that many of us, if we are lucky enough to have that opportunity, think of the Louvre or go to the Louvre mm-hmm. as a repository for the great art of the past. So what he's actually showing us is a particular space. It's one gallery in the Louvre. It's one you can still visit today. It's called the Salon Carré. And the Louvre began its life as a building, as a royal palace, and then it became administrative offices. And then it was opened to the public as a museum by the revolutionary government in 1793. And then Napoleon and subsequent kings thought it was such a good idea mm-hmm. to kind of keep it open that they did. So it's an important collection, and this particular room is an important space within the museum mm-hmm. because this was the sort of central hub, the kind of most privileged space for paintings to be mm-hmm. displayed. Now, that's not to say that Morse just goes and sits down and shows us what was on the wall in, right. at the Salon Carré at that time. And what he actually shows us are 38 paintings and two sculptures. And they're hung in this single space. During the period of time, this style of hang would have been called a salon style mm-hmm. hang. And it actually comes from the Salon Carré and this habit of hanging paintings floor to ceiling and butting upright against one another. But these works never hung in this way in this space. Instead, he has combed through the Louvre's collection of more than 1,000 paintings to select these 38 mm-hmm. and added the two sculptures. And he actually had his own canvas and easel in the galleries of the Louvre. So you can see in the painting that there are a number of art students who are working, but we can imagine also that Morse would have been like one of these students. Mm-hmm. He actually had a special scaffolding erected so that he could climb up and get a closer look at works that would have been hung higher up. And when he created this work, he probably used a drawing device that was common at the time called the camera obscura. Mm-hmm. So when we look at the paintings that he's selected, we might recognize the Mona Lisa, maybe, in the very bottom row. Mm-hmm. It's sort of weird to see the Mona Lisa in what we might see as like a non-privileged
right,
position.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Also, interestingly, there are some works here that are by artists that are not either well-remembered today or especially revered. So, for example, in the late 18th and early 19th century, everybody loved the Spanish painter Esteban Murillo, mm-hmm. and Murillo is not someone that you read mm-hmm. a lot about right. Today. So we get a sense, too, that although these are famous works, they're works that were famous at that moment, and they're also a little bit idiosyncratic. So, for example, Morse includes a Caravaggio painting. And although we love Caravaggio today and, right. and students are always excited to learn about him, mm-hmm. he was pretty unfashionable up until the later 19th century. Mm-hmm. So we can see when yes. we start to look at these individual works on display that it's not necessarily the best paintings. It's not necessarily the most famous paintings. Instead, it's a selection of works that supported his own theories about art, mm-hmm. and that really would be a complement to the kind of system of artistic education that he had been working on establishing in the United States. Right. So the two sculptures, just to give them a shout out, mm-hmm. are maybe two of the most famous works in the Louvre's collection, especially in the 19th century. We might think of the Venus de Milo as being more famous, mm-hmm. but at the time, Diana and the Huntress, which is in the far right corner, was more revered. Mm-hmm. And in the far left was something called the Borghese vase, which had been bought by Napoleon mm-hmm. in 1808. It's interesting to note in terms of Morse's own theory of the United States and American identity, that the Gallery of the Louvre is full of what we could call essentially Catholic art. Mm-hmm. 15 of the 38 paintings are drawn from the Judeo-Christian tradition, right. but many of them specifically address themes related to Catholicism, like the Immaculate Conception. Mm-hmm. A few years after this work, in 1835, he wrote a pamphlet where he bemoaned the foreign influence in the United States, mm-hmm. particularly elements associated with the Catholic Church. He had a major concern that immigration during this period from Ireland and also parts of Germany meant that there were large numbers of Catholics settling in the United States, and that the idea was that Catholics would be loyal to the Pope mm-hmm. as a sort of heavenly as well as worldly ruler, rather than to the government of wherever they were settling. So when we look at the selection of works and think about sort of Morse's career and his interests, it's a pretty interesting mix, because he's not promoting these works in particular mm-hmm. in some ways. So he's not that interested, we could say, in subject matter. Mm-hmm. But what he is interested in is how they approach artistic problems or questions, right. The way in which each of them addresses a particular ideal or responds to a particular artistic challenge. Mm-hmm. So, for example, one of the theories that Morse posited in terms of creating a successful composition is that the eye follows particular colors. Mm-hmm. And he especially talked about red mm-hmm. as being an important compositional element in a painting. Yeah. So we can think about, when we start to look at the Gallery of the Louvre, where are there particular uses of red in each of the paintings to give us that sense of moving the eye around a composition. Mm-hmm. He talked about the importance of order in a painting, so wanting to convey narrative, but also structure that narrative in a way that it creates a kind of pleasing and harmonious composition. Mm-hmm. And that is actually a kind of significant artistic challenge that he himself has to address in the creation of the painting. Mm-hmm. So how do you combine 38 paintings from different periods and styles and different palettes into one unified composition?
Right.
And one of the things that he does is to regularize the frames. Mm-hmm. So many of these works were in more elaborate frames than Morse shows them. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing he does is he gives us this kind of way out. We have a visual way out through the doorway space that opens up into another gallery. So this kind of doorway space that gives us a sense of the recession of space beyond, it anchors the composition, mm-hmm. and it also suggests the way in which the collection of the Louvre continues. Mm-hmm. And Morse was also a proponent of what he called the balance of variety and uniformity. So we get that sense, for example, a number of the portraits that are in the painting feature dark clothing. So the way that they're placed, he's not grouping them all together, mm-hmm. for example, but sort of spreading them out to achieve that sense of variety, but also giving us the sense of their uniformity. One of the reasons that I'm particularly interested in this work is that it's part of a popular genre for mm-hmm. painting at this time called gallery painting. And I think it's important for us to recall that when we're faced with works such as this one, we shouldn't necessarily take them as documents, mm-hmm. but instead we should think about the ways in which they're aspirational, mm-hmm. whether that's a private collector saying, this is what I would want to own, or selective, all of the best works in one place, which was a kind of popular trope, or in the case of Morse, which I think is maybe more interesting, this idea of looking to the artistic past for a series of lessons that could then be learned and mm-hmm. carried into the future.
So in thinking about the composition of Gallery of the Louvre, can it be seen as a kind of code or a kind of method of transmission itself?
Well, that's a really interesting question. Certainly we have this very interesting historical fact that while in Paris working on this painting, Morse becomes interested in the sort of semaphore system and modes of communication. And while he's on his way home, he comes up with the idea of the telegraph and later coins the term, or the electromagnetic telegraph, and they actually coins the term the telegram, mm-hmm. which is the, you know, the written document that results from the telegraph. Yeah. So I think there's sort of two things happening here in terms of communication or transmission, mm-hmm. or maybe coding.
Yeah.
We could think about it. First is the selection of the pictures, their strategic arrangement, and the way in which they're meant to communicate an idea of what art can and should be for an audience. One of the debates that Morse really enters into with this painting is the debate that many museums faced at this time, which is, what is the best way to organize your collection? Mm-hmm. What's the best way to organize the information? Yeah. Is it chronological? Is it along national lines? Is it thematically? Is it in terms of type? So this is the room with all the landscapes. This is the room with all the portraits. And Morris instead selects what we could call a formal approach. In some ways, I think he's more interested in color and composition, what in art history we call the formal qualities of a work of art, rather than national origin, narrative, or particular genres. So it's interesting to think about the kind of information that's encoded in this painting, because it's of a very particular type. And part of this is about the artistic ideal of emulation. It might seem foreign to us today to think that so much emphasis would have been given on the past in terms of artistic training. Mm-hmm. We tend to think of artists as originals.
Right.
And in fact, emulation, the ability to successfully copy what artists had done in the past, was an important principle in art. Mm-hmm. So actually in the painting, we see copyists, a number of copyists. Three of them are women, which is a sort of interesting idea. Copying was considered important for the professional artist, who was usually a man. Mm-hmm. But women were also encouraged to have some aspect, especially gentle women, were encouraged to have some aspect of artistic training. And in the gendered language of the time, it was thought that women were more adept at imitation. It's interesting. This is why when early writers write about photography, they often gender photography as female, mm-hmm. because it's a copy, where men were thought to be better at artistic invention. And actually, if you look at the painting, and the only copy or copyist that you can see producing a work, where you can see the work, is in the lower left-hand corner. Mm-hmm. And that's actually not a copy. It's an original composition. Ah. So we have a kind of example in the work of what you're supposed to do with right. the painting. You're mm-hmm. supposed to look at the past for artistic lessons, but you're not supposed to copy it. You're supposed to use that as a way to kind of invent your own artistic statement. Mm-hmm. So there is this sense broadly of trying to transmit knowledge, trying to encode knowledge. And then we also have the historical fact of Morse code mm-hmm. and the yeah. telegraph. Morse's career, discussions of Morse's career are usually divided into sort of two discrete periods. Mm-hmm. Morse the artist, not very successful, and Morse the inventor, successful. But as the painting, and indeed as the exhibition suggests, certain themes run throughout both areas of his work. And if we think about transmission, it's really a question of how do you communicate across space mm-hmm. and through time.
Right.
So the works of art on display are one mode of transmission. The painting itself that Morse has created is another. And then the electromagnetic telegraph and Morse code provide a third. So it's interesting to think about this possibility that sort of intellectually they're working on the same line.
Yeah.
One of the problems or questions, though, around Morse code and the telegraph is that it's an unvisual medium.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So some scholars have resisted this direct one-to-one, mm-hmm. but I think that when we frame it as this larger question of transmission,
yeah.
that it's sort of key to thinking about artists and scientists together.
Mm-hmm. Thinking further about the different aspects of Morse's careers mm-hmm. and his relationships to technology. So he creates this painting to make Renaissance and Baroque paintings available to American audience. Today, most people experience works of arts, at least initially or not entirely, through photographic representation. So how does the development of photography fit in with Morse's career?
Well, this is, I think, another point where we can try and reunite Morse the painter with Morse the inventor. Mm-hmm. As we know through the telegraph and also through this painting, he was definitely interested in imitation.
Yeah.
Or what we might call mechanical imitation. Some people have used the term mechanical reproduction. The fact that you could use a device like a camera to record or transcribe what is before you, and that you could minimize deviation from the original.
Mm-hmm.
So when Morse is creating this work, he's using a device that's called the camera obscura. And this is a drawing device that came about during Renaissance discoveries and sort of intersection of art and science. And the name in Latin, it literally means dark chamber, camera, mm-hmm. chamber, obscura, dark. And it's based on the fact that when you have a dark room and you create a small opening in that room, the size of the pinhole, size of a pinhole, or it could be larger depending on the size of your room, that what is outside of that room will be projected onto the interior of the room, mm-hmm. except upside down. So you could use a mirror if you wanted to flip it around.
Yeah.
And this is actually the basis for the photographic camera. I'm talking about the 35 millimeter ones.
Right, right.
Not the digital ones. From the late 18th century, artists and scientists had been experimenting with how you might record the image projected by the camera. Mm-hmm. These ideas had been swirling around Europe and even America for a while, and Morse did manage to produce a very early example of what we would think of as a negative image. But he couldn't figure out the chemistry to print it as a positive. Mm-hmm. So there was a kind of limitation, and he stalled out. But he was one of the first Americans to see the photograph firsthand. Mm-hmm. When the process was finally announced to the public, it was in Paris in 1839, and Morse was actually back there and was able to see it. And so he was one of the first Americans to actually see a photograph.
Right, yeah. He meets Daguerre, right?
He meets Daguerre, he sees them. Yeah. It's kind of amazing to think about being one of the first to experience a new technology. I don't know if that's how some people felt, you know, when they opened their internet Netscape
right.
first time. And so he learns how to do this type of photography, and then he goes back to the United States and he teaches others how to do it, and he does it himself. Mm-hmm. So we can see this Morse as painter, Morse as inventor of telegraph, and Morse as promoter of photography, all within the same ambit of imitation mm-hmm. and the transmission of knowledge. Mm-hmm. So how can you take what is in one place and move it across space and time to right. increase knowledge elsewhere?
So now taking in this history of Morse and of the painting, what other kinds of questions and challenges to our assumptions as viewers does the Gallery of the Louvre present to a contemporary audience?
To me, the most fascinating challenge or question of this painting is, what do you do in front of a work of art? Mm-hmm. And I think this is maybe something that goes back to my own childhood of being taken to museums, but never really told anything about art. Museums were something in a kind of middle-class, culturally aspirational way that you should go to them, but no one ever saying, look at this, look at that, or what's the story. And so sometimes when I find myself in a museum, I just think, what should I be doing here, right?
Yeah.
And so this idea of what you do in front of a work of art and what you should do in front of a work of art. So there are all sorts of different types of experiences on display in the painting. There is the study and the copying of the works. There's the engagement and conversation that we see. There's the artist who looks to the past but creates his own work. Mm-hmm. And there's even, bizarrely, the inclusion of these two figures, a mother and child, who are dressed very distinctly in the peasant costume mm-hmm. of the Brittany region mm-hmm. of France. So this idea that you travel to see works of art mm-hmm. and that it's potentially a kind of universal experience mm-hmm. that even peasants from the countryside know yeah. that they should come to the Louvre. Mm-hmm. I think for us looking today, too, there's also this important question that you can't always take what you see as evidence.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And this space that we see in the painting never existed in this way with these people in this one moment. But that doesn't mean that Morse was trying to trick us or even to lie about it. Rather, I think it gets back to the idea of virtual reality. Mm-hmm. The idea that this painting acknowledges the special work that art can do. It can conjure a world that's very like our own, but is not actually our own. Mm-hmm. And it's in that gap between what we know from our experience and what we see depicted that art can prompt us to think about our own culture and to think about our own experiences.
That was Borna O'Neill on Samuel Morse in the Gallery of the Louvre. Don't miss the exhibition Samuel F.B. Morse's Gallery of the Louvre and the Art of Invention at the Rinalda House Museum of American Art, opening Friday, February 17th, and running through June 4th. Visit humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/podcast for links to more information on Morse's painting and a video on the Camera Obscura. You can also find more episodes of Humanities Viewpoints there, as well as on iTunes in the podcast section. Thanks for listening.